Hello, I'm Lorena Allam. Welcome to Hindsight. Today, New Earth, a journey into the landscape of 19th century Australia. Scientific discovery was the key in the 19th century, and geology in particular emerged as a force to be reckoned with. This new science challenged the biblical timeframe for creation and perceptions of the known world. At the time, Australia, though still a convict colony, had developed a little-known but thriving scientific and artistic community. And one figure that loomed large was the clergyman geologist W.B. Clarke. Clarke was also in regular correspondence with the eminent scientists, including Charles Darwin. At the same time, the artist Eugene von Gerard, deeply influenced by his fascination with geology, was creating a new aesthetic of the Australian landscape. Both men arrived in Australia in the early 19th century, and although they never met, they had an uncannily similar appreciation of the Australian landscape and its people. New Earth was produced by Ros Bluett.
It's rough and it's wild. And just the formations of the rocks, like there is no one formation that is the same as the one beside it.
In the late 18th century, the famous botanist Joseph Banks insisted that the Great South Land be called Terra Australis. He considered the country akin to the discovery of a new species, hitherto unknown and mysterious. And the landscape of Australia has enthralled newcomers ever since. But it was during the mid-19th century that this South Land was firmly established on the world's geological map. It was also at this time that the beauty of the Australian landscape was acknowledged for its uniqueness. Interestingly, the volcanic region of southwestern Victoria, now known as the Kanawinka Geopark, has been added to the United Nations list of significant geological sites. Val Wrench is a volunteer guide through this new World Heritage region.
There's a big bit there, and then it'll go up to narrow bits of the basalt.
Yeah.
And then you have the different, quite orange scoria right down to a real burgundy scoria, and then followed by bluestone again.
It's amazing, the layers, the way they're so obvious.
It is.
Early geological observations of colonial Australia were due in large part to the arrival of two ambitious men. William Bramwhite Clarke, an English clergyman geologist, and the Austrian painter, Eugene von Gerard.
I love the custard bit up here where it's almost like a wrinkly hand and it's just actually set like that. It's almost like an artist at work, isn't it?
Both men were captivated by the new science of geology and what it offered for a greater understanding of their world.
Von Gerard is going to the new world. He's painting its botany, its geology, its geography. He has this sense that it's his duty to come to this new country and to portray it in a truthful way.
Clarke comes to open up what he says a new earth for geology.
The two men followed their separate callings, one with a paintbrush and the other a geological hammer. This is a short journey into the work of these remarkable men of colonial Australia as they introduced the new earth of Terra Australis to the rest of the 19th century world.
Sydney, 1839. Dear Mother, the coves are perfectly beautiful. The whole harbour looks like a lake, and the rocks on its banks, interspersed with shrubs and plants of curious foliage. Here and there a dry, solitary trunk rising up in grandeur. These are old trees, and I would not cut them down. They are the relics of the forest as it was, in the days of its primeval dignity, when the lords of the soil roamed at their will, and were not branded as savages by comers from the other end of the globe.
Besides hammering at rock, W.B. Clarke was a prolific correspondent and contributor to the major scientific journals of his day. Science historian Anne Moyle spent a decade piecing together over 800 of Clark's letters, gleaning much about his personality in the process.
Clark arrives with this great sense of mission in two directions, both serving God but also serving science.
The year that Clark arrived in Sydney, 1839, coincided with the death of William Smith, the first Briton to determine the age and sequence of geological strata through fossils. It was remarked that Clark carried his torch to the Antipodes. A decade later, Eugene von Gerard arrived in Melbourne from the Dusseldorf School of Landscape Art. He was influenced by the great German natural scientist Alexander von Humboldt. Art historian Ruth Pullen has studied the work of von Gerard intimately.
And he argued that geology, or the geognostic landscape, was the future of landscape painting. By painting the Earth's form, the rocks and so on, you're telling a great history, the history of the Earth, this history that stretched back over an unimaginable time frame.
Past, present and future all rush together to carry away the mind by storm. I'm 41 years old. Scarcely 10 years before I was born was this country first colonized. I look around and marvel at such effects flowing from crime. Who would limit the power or prescribe the agency of him who, out of evil, adduces good?
Clark's wife, Maria, decides that she cannot live in a convict country and that her children cannot be educated in a convict country. So in a hot January of 1842, she sails off with the three children, with Clark standing on the escarpment at Southhead looking. And Maria has done a great favour to Australian science because Clark then fills his evenings developing his correspondence, and he builds up a formidable network of communications, which is the very lifeblood of science.
Just gentle little hills in between. And there's quite a few to the east, and to the southwest is where all the scoria flow basically went. But there is still a lot of underground rocks in the paddocks towards the north. When they plough, they usually get 10 tonnes to the acre of rocks.
The sandstone of this formation is mostly a soft, friable rock of fine texture and light sandy colour. It consists of minute grains of quartz with particles of decomposed feldspar of an opaque white colour and scales of light-coloured mica. The colours of the layers are white, greyish-white and yellowish, like ordinary sand.
Associate Professor of Geoscience at the University of Wollongong, Robert Young has taken a particular interest in W.B. Clark. Now retired, Robert Young is a lay reader in the Anglican Church and an admirer of the ease in which Clark mixed religion and science.
Clark was really presenting a geological history of a continent unlike anything that had really been investigated in the Northern Hemisphere, for that matter, in most other parts of the Southern Hemisphere. It was almost the channel through which new information was flowing into Europe, and European geologists were then able to see a broader picture with the Australian material fitting into it. Both had an interest in landscape, Clark putting it in writing, von Gerard putting it down in paint.
Weatherboard Creek Falls, Blue Mountains, 1862.
The one in front of us is the largest and quite fantastic painting of the Weatherboard Creek Falls. It was a very challenging topic for him, a very challenging subject. By conveying a sense of the history of the landscape, you could create a painting with the depth of meaning that was normally associated with history painting. Here was the history of the Earth told through its geological structure, through its geomorphology. It actually was quite a popular view, and a number of other painters had addressed this subject, but von Gerhard really takes it from a very strongly geological point of view. He seems to be interested in depicting the layers of sandstone, the layers of rock, in great detail.
The Blue Mountains west of Sydney mesmerised newcomers with the sheer grandeur of their cliffs, valleys and gorges. 3 years before the geologist Clark arrived, Charles Darwin, on his voyage to Australia on the Beagle, was puzzled by how they might have been formed. W.B. Clark continued many of Darwin's studies in Australia, and the two men corresponded frequently, particularly after the publishing of Origin of Species.
And of course, when Darwin came to Australia and went to the Blue Mountains, he couldn't believe that rivers could have cut the great gorges around Katoomba, and argued that they had to be essentially ancient marine features which would have been modified only by the streams. Clark started to see the problems in Darwin's interpretation and moved closer to the idea that the streams flowing through the valleys had done much of the erosion. It's a complicated, a very, very complicated picture through the 19th century, and it's only in the last few decades that the idea of rivers being the dominant agent in shaping the landscape really gains very wide acceptance.
I think that he's also interested in conveying a sense of the new awareness of the age, of the time that would have been involved in wearing away that great valley. And you see the waterfall on one side and the rain clouds and storm moving in from the other side, almost as if he's alerting us to the fact that this great geological chasm has been weathered away by these agents over millennia. And this was all very controversial at the time. It was a new understanding of how the Earth had been formed.
There's almost the triumph of fluvialism, I guess, fluvial being river erosion. It's round about then in Australia. It simply meant that you had to have a time span greater than six 24-hour days. And the moment one accepted that, there was no real problem. One could see, as Clark himself put it, the hand of the creator, and the obvious thing for anyone who had the ability was to pursue how the creator, if you like, made creation.
He begins to collect fossils. Part of Clark's mission is to discover the correlations between the stratigraphy in Australia and that in England, and also to notice the differences, which are very real in many places. And putting himself down in rugged country,
just makes you feel how little we are when you stand in just the quarry area here, brilliant red of the scoria, and then beyond that you have lots of cypress and pine trees.
In few places in the world can the quiet and daily processes of natural growth and decay, the forms of living and dead things, and the successive changes and reproductions of matter owing to the operations of the most powerful, though secretly evolving causes, be so prominently displayed as in the singular picture of the past and the present.
Charles Darwin and W.B. Clark both studied under the eminent Cambridge geologist Adam Sedgwick. He, with William Buckland, did much work on fossil history, their evidence indicating that the Earth was certainly of an immense age. Clark continued their work in Australia, trekking far inland and through rugged country for evidence of rock types and layers.
Clark's reputation, I guess, is built on his deciphering of the stratigraphy of the actual layers of rock and how they were laid down in Eastern Australia. He could see the changes in life forms in the older rocks of Devonian age, the older folded rocks. He could then see the changes up into the Permian rocks above them and then into the Triassic rocks. Some major changes, particularly, of course, at the close of the Permian. He was providing lots of new evidence to fit a picture which was already emerging.
He packs up great collections of fossils because they're the key to understanding the stratigraphy of the country, and sends them off to Sedgwick at Cambridge. And it's the beginning of a great flow of geological knowledge from Clark. His first correspondence is always with Professor the Reverend Adam Sedgwick.
It has often struck me that we want a scientific club here for the purpose of recording observations on Australian natural history, which in the actual state of things are every day made only to be forever lost. A society of working bees who would talk only on subjects they had read up and who would record their observations and the inferences they might draw would, I think, do great good for the general cause of science.
Clark was building on the groundwork that Sedgwick had laid, but he was doing it at the other end of the world. Clark was the clearinghouse for geological material coming out of Australia. I think that's probably the best way of putting it.
He would write his letters at night, both candlelight, and write his reports, because he sent reports back constantly. And it's an enormous, it gives insight into, one, the knowledge content of geology at the time, the experience of a pioneering geologist in an unknown land, and the methodology, the conflicts that arise, the tensions, the fights over the fossils, and it gives such an insight into the whole intellectual life of the colony. And many historians have tended to write about the barrenness of life in Australia, but they're quite wrong.
Von Gerard arrived to Melbourne with quite extraordinary people around him. I mean, you have the botanist, Ferdinand von Müller, world-class botanist, German botanist, Georg von Neumeier, Ludwig Becker. There's a whole group of eminent scientific, artistic Germans and British people here in the colonies. And he travels with Neumeier to Cape Otway and also to Kosciuszko. And he's really there, that sort of nexus between art and science is seen in a very real way, because it's the artist and the scientist travelling side by side, the scientist making his scientific readings, the artist with his sketchbook recording the landscape, recording phenomena in his way, and that kind of complementary nature of art and science, both equally valid ways of understanding the world around him. And he says in a remarkable letter, he talks about the difficulties of actually discovering and travelling, and he mentions that he travelled by foot, on horseback, by sea. So
He endured great hardship, but I think he also enjoyed the adventure of the expeditions as well, and especially when he travelled in a party, perhaps with scientists and other artists, there's a sense of real camaraderie and enjoyment of the experience.
And Clark, putting himself down in rugged country, when he does his great surveys, he does it with two assigned servants. And they have the most dramatic time crossing flooded rivers. Sometimes the servants won't follow him. And sleeping out on an opossum rug under the stars and in tents. It's tremendous endurance and stamina. He becomes, as someone once described, like an ant crawling over a log. And that's the sort of analogy that a geologist in the 19th century, armed with a geological hammer and his eyes, confronted. And it was an enormous venture.
It's rough and it's wild. The people that lived here, they used to get lost in the timber. If you look over these little mounds as part of the landscape, you have rocks jutting out, the odd bit of livestock, trees.
I think so many people found that our landscape, when they came here as settlers or visitors, very alien, and even Darwin complained about the leaves, that they shed no shade, and there was something terribly strange about it. And, of course, it's not till the late 19th century that people begin to, the settlers begin to find the real beauty of this country and see it with their own colonial eyes.
Wattles with their subtle yellows, then the silver grey rocks with moss on them, and then the drying ferns, which at this time of year are frosted up, so they give you a pinky sort of a grey colour. So the colours are very earthy.
View of the snowy bluff on the Wonongatta River, 1864.
This is an expedition. This is the Gippsland.
That's beautiful, isn't it?
View of the snowy bluff on the Wonongatta River. And he travelled into that area with Alfred Howitt. But it was a really, really rugged expedition. And there are wonderful letters written by Howitt giving an account of the hardships that they experienced on the way. But here in Von Gerard's painting of it, he gives a sense of the grandeur of the landscape, but also you can see a group of a little indigenous family in the foreground.
You look at Von Gerard's paintings, he treats the Australian landscape as it is, but at the same time is coming from a mid-19th century German artistic perspective. Clark certainly treats the Australian landscape as it is, but he's coming from an English early 19th century perspective. And they can sympathise with another perspective, the perspective of the native peoples. I think that's perfectly clear, and this comes out in Clark's interest in Aboriginal religious beliefs and connections to the land.
My experience enables me to speak in the most favourable terms of the Aborigines, whose degraded position in the midst of the white population affords no just criterion of their merits. The quickness of comprehension of those in the interior is very extraordinary. For nothing in all the complicated adaptations we carried with us either surprised or puzzled them. They're never awkward. On the contrary, in manners and general intelligence, they appear superior to any class of white rustics that I've seen. Their powers of mimicry seem extraordinary, and their shrewdness shines even through the medium of imperfect language and renders them, in general, very agreeable companions.
And I think that's the kind of attitude that von Gerard brings to his portrayal of Indigenous people. He shows the Indigenous people in a state of almost dispossession as travellers, not on their own land, but moving through the property of a white landlord.
Clark is modern in many ways in his concern for what was happening to the environment. He's deep concern for what was happening to the Aborigines. And I guess in that he shares that sympathy with von Gerard, because in von Gerard's paintings, Aborigines are there. They're going from the land. You can see that in his paintings. They're definitely disappearing from the landscape, but they are there. He and von Gerard shared that real sympathy. They could recognise the tragedy of what was happening.
Both men's profound attachment to the land and its people spilled over into their work. The two travelled to the Victorian goldfields during the 1850s, but they were more intent on pursuing meaningful riches in their individual endeavours.
I have never felt so much on late occasions the value of the office of a messenger of grace and salvation. It is to be hoped I may never be reproached with forsaking my calling to seek for the gold that perishes. For the judgments of the Lord, which I proclaimed amidst the mountains, are more to be desired than gold, yea, than fine gold.
Heard him described as a geologist rather than as a churchman, which is a load of absolute nonsense. He was the most influential churchman in Australia at the time, more so than the bishops. Now, very much interested in church matters, and nor did at any stage that he let his interest in science dominate to the degree that he really wasn't doing his job as a clergyman. Even on the large trips that the state government sent him on to the goldfields, every Sunday he would collect whatever people he could find, and church was held wherever they happened to be. And there was never any doubt of him losing his faith to any degree whatsoever. When Darwin's book, Origin of Species, came to Australia, there was a great furore about it from people who thought their faith was being threatened. Clark, on the other hand, thought it was a marvellous piece of work and couldn't see what everyone was upset about. Unfortunately, the emphasis on 24-hour days tended to increase towards the end of the 19th century. And it's there where you start to find the big split occurring within religion over the question of the age of the earth. Even then, of course, they really didn't know how old it was. But it was obvious that 24-hour days just wouldn't account for what was already coming out in geology. And most of this, of course, long predates Darwin.
Clark had a very open mind about science, and he was tremendously impressed with The Origin of Species. He read it when it arrived in Australia, about 6 months after its publication, and he's at once in correspondence with Darwin. The tragedy of that first letter he wrote, is that the first page is missing in the Darwin correspondence. So whether he was saying, this is excellent and I agree with you, we don't know. But he really wrote to him as a fellow geologist, and they corresponded quite a lot. And Darwin particularly asked him if he would also do some a little biological research from him on bees, because he had tried to get von Mueller to do some inquiries for him, and he refused because he thoroughly disapproved of Darwin's work, as did almost every other scientist or naturalist in Australia at that time. But Clark, when he becomes the founder of the Royal Society and he gives the first inaugural address, he doesn't mention Darwin per se, but he does say to those scientists, you must keep an open mind and take every evidence that's coming to light now as part of your equipment.
We must strive to discern clearly, understand fully, and report faithfully. To love truth in things physical as in things moral, to abjure hasty theories and unsupported conjectures. Where we are in doubt, not to be positive. To give our brother observer the same measure of credit we take to ourselves. Not striving for mastery, but having time for the formation of the judgment which will inevitably be given, whether for or against us, by those who come after. Contented if we are able to add but one grain to that enduring pyramid which is now in the course of erection as the testimony of nature to the truth of revelation.
The major problem in Darwin's work, which Darwin himself recognised, he recognises this at several places in Origin of Species, was the lack of the intermediate life form between one type and another. The other thing which I think Clark certainly emphasised, which and it was a point that Darwin tended to gloss over, were the mass extinctions which one could see in the geological record. I mean, the classic one of those we know now, the end of the of Permian times, 250 million years ago, 90% of all species of life forms in the ocean disappeared, and disappeared very quickly. About 70% of all vertebrates on land disappeared very quickly, whereas land plants tended to survive more or less without marked change. And it was this sort of thing which troubled Clark. One of the examples he gives is the disappearance of the giant marsupials in Australia. He came to the conclusion that it wasn't really survival of the fittest that caused their replacement by smaller forms, but he felt that something catastrophic had happened, and they were wiped out. They'd just gone too quickly. He doesn't seem to have been able to put his finger on why.
Can you see a kangaroo? There was one heavy before. Some over there. They're very well camouflaged. You wouldn't. The grey of the rocks camouflage the grey kangaroos here, so they've seen us and they've run away. This area has quite a bit of bird life. We normally have some wedge-tailed eagles that fly around, but I can't see any of those today. There's a family of wallabies up here and a huge family now of grey kangaroos that live on the mountain and jump down amongst the rocks in the crater. So it's and lots of finches and other little bird life.
Mount Kosciuszko.
Here we're seeing these bare bones, the exposed rocks, telling us about the formation of this earth. Interestingly, W.B. Clark had travelled through Kosciuszko earlier, or the high plains, the plateau, and he had recognised the glacial character of that landscape and recognised that there had been glacial activity there. But for von Gerard, he was feeling this was the history painting of the earth. Contemporaries saw it as very confronting. In fact, the early reviewers, or one reviewer, what did he say? It was terribly true to nature, but most uncomfortable to look at. To me, von Gerard's painting of Mount Kosciuszko is the absolutely archetypal geognostic landscape. And he looks down, and again he sees the rocks exposed in this bare, harsh landscape. And he paints this wonderful work, looking out over the mountain ranges. But the foreground, the first ridge we see, is Watson's Crag, and it's painted just as it looks today, with these exposed clusters of rock. He paints it in springtime, and there are great drifts of snow, but it's this harsh, bare land. And here I think he's telling us this landscape, this is an ancient landscape, and here we see the history of its formation exposed before us, the bare bones of the earth.
I think Clark certainly did have that same reverence for the landscape. He saw a great beauty in the landscape, particularly, say, in dramatic scenes like the west side of the Snowy Mountains. But he was also extremely upset by what was happening to the landscape. And at one stage he talked about the vandalic extermination of Australian flora and fauna. This really did concern him a great deal. He knew that the colony was going to grow, but it was what was happening that really, really concerned him. So, yes, I think in that sense he probably did share same sentiment with von Gerard. There's any doubt of that at all.
This link between science and landscape keeps occurring. Clark was born in Constable country at East Burghold, the most beautiful old church, and he became a curate there for a while. He was a boy when Constable was painting the mill, and they obviously knew each other, and Constable does mention him as a young man. And I always hoped I'd find a Constable lurking among his papers, but nothing fell out of that character. But it probably had a great effect on him, because he was very much a man who was alert to landscape and beauty and the poetry of nature.
See on the power thing?
Oh yeah.
Up on top?
Yes.
It's a robin redbreast. He's not turning around
his
red.
White. You can see the little white.
Yes, but it's got a red breast if he turns around and we get closer. It's probably a female. Here, see his red breast?
Yes.
That's why we put trees on them out. It's a real little treat to see a little robin redbreast. They just come here for the winter. He's got a black and white V on his back. He's really showing off for us, isn't he? Yeah, you don't often see those, so you're very, very privileged. It's just a lovely little bird, isn't he?
Von Gerard is painting from a perspective that's informed by Humboldt. Humboldt is a great scientist, but a scientist working pre-Darwin. So still that scientific way of understanding the Earth, of wanting to comprehend its geology and the botany and meteorology and so on, was still all seen as part of a bigger picture and still all seemed to be informed by some controlling being. Humboldt doesn't actually mention God specifically, but he does give a sense of the interconnectedness of all elements of creation, and I think that's what underpins von Gerard's work, is that sense of a unifying force. So there is that spiritual essence, that sense that some other element informs all aspects of the natural world.
I love the custard bit up here where it's almost like a wrinkly hand, and it's just actually set like that.
This is amazing.
It's almost like an artist at work, isn't it? God made this one. We could sign this and put God on the bottom.
He has a real sense of our landscape, though he comes from the German tradition in which God is so particularly a part of their representation.
To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. So therefore, we may justly infer, there is a time which men may, and can, look upon the universe about them, and endeavour to discover the laws by which the Creator formed it. The laws of nature were not appointed by the great lawgiver to baffle his creatures in the sphere of conduct, still less to confound them in the region of belief.
Clark's view was that the Creator didn't just do it once in 6 days, but you could see the hand of the Creator in the geological record through the great extinctions and then the great flowering of later life forms, etc. And it was that in the long run that he objected to in Darwin's work. If you look at the very last chapter of Origin of Species, Darwin is still there talking about the role of the Creator. But the Creator, in a sense, is almost there, the Creator of the Enlightenment. He winds up the clock and away it goes. Species then struggle against each other. The survival of the fittest is put into play. Clark felt that that was just too mechanistic and that really creation was going on continuously. Because at one point, in one of his letters, he said that he thought that what was alive now would in future be fossil. And so in that sense, I think he was very, very prescient. I suppose one of the astonishing things in the late 19th century and early 20th century is how widely Darwin's views became spread through almost all aspects of science and culture. No matter what the subject was, Darwinism, and I say Darwinism rather than Darwin, was correct in music. I mean, I can remember reading books on music 50 years ago, in which everything was being graded towards a more progressive form. Wagner had to be better than Bach because Wagner was later. This sort of stuff was... And likewise in art. One can see the same sort of comments from art critics.
And the very intricately painted historical landscapes of the late 19th century were not immune to this evolutionary zeal.
During the mid-1850s, the 1860s, von Gerard was highly, highly regarded. In the 1870s, there was a sort of a shift, a change in mood. Louis Bouvelot arrived in Melbourne, and the sense of open-air painting, Barbizon school-style painting, started to gain momentum, and von Gerard's very detailed style of painting started to look a little bit old-fashioned. And when von Gerard left Australia in 1882, really, from that time on, he was little thought of. His paintings were, you know, with the rise of Impressionism and then abstraction in the 20th century, his paintings languished in the basements of public art galleries.
Silhouette of the Grampians, best in Victoria.
Looking out northward to the Grampians, and we think that that's probably where he sat, probably on a log. So here we are in what we call the saddle of the mound. It's actually, when you look back from the mound, it looks like a saddle in it. And we're looking out over towards the Grampians.
Beautiful.
The mountain that you first see is Mount Abrupt. That's Dunkill.
Wow.
And good. Beside it is Mount Sturgeon. So that would be the mountain, I think, that's in your painting.
But at the same time, you've got the coast with the vegetation and the writhing, twisting plant forms, and you get the sense of it all being, I don't know, in some way infused by some kind of inner life, you know, inner energy. So it's this dark, primeval, dense vegetation, writhing branches. And certainly Karus had a theory. He talked about a Lebensbildkunst, or the earth life painting, as if everything in the earth was sort of animated, or, you know, that it responded to some inner energy or life force. And you do get that sense in this particular painting, don't you?
I think von Gerhard has a brilliant eye for it. He's more than just putting something down photographically. It's more than that. Like all the great German Romantic painters, the painting itself is alive, precisely recording some aspect of nature. But then the whole composition lifts one out of nature almost. To see some of his really great works, one is seeing the detail of nature recorded lovingly, but the whole composition lifts you up to another level altogether. He's being true to the land, but he's also being true to himself, I think, and his tradition.
Von Gerhard had brought an understanding and a vivid depiction of Australian landscape before the world. By the century's close, colonial Australia had established its place in the art world and in the scientific domain.
The first von Gerhard to go back into a public art gallery was his painting of Strath Creek, and it went to the Art Gallery of New South Wales in, I think, about 1967, I can't remember the exact date. Then there was research, major exhibition in 1980, and of course a complete revision of our thinking and new recognition of von Gerhard and his importance.
Similarly, William Branwhite Clark was not honoured publicly until 1988. In Australia's bicentennial year, he was finally acknowledged as one of the 200 people who have significantly contributed to Australia's scientific development.
He had a sense of the destiny of the history and of his part in it. He was quite an ambitious man. And it's an accident of history that the person who has this sense becomes the record.
In New Earth, you heard from Val Wrench at the Kanawinka Geopark in Victoria.
Those birds over there are mountain ducks. They are paired up for the spring, I would say. There's a little love match happening.
Dr. Robert Young, retired Associate Professor of Geoscience at the University of Wollongong and lay reader in the Anglican Church.
It's very difficult to think of any field of human endeavour which wasn't in some way influenced by Darwin's followers. Let's be fair to Charlie himself, rather his followers, who pursued it to the nth degree.
Art historian Dr. Ruth Pullen.
His response to light, you get a sense of an all-encompassing vision of the natural world.
Author and historian of science, Dr. Anne Moyle.
At the heart of it all is the landscape, the stratigraphy, the fossils. Yes, he was locating Australia on the world scene, geologically.
New Earth was produced by Ros Bluett, and the sound engineer was Judy Rapley. And an exhibition featuring the work of Eugene von Gerhard, called Nature Revealed, is currently on at the National Gallery of Victoria until early August, and then it tours around the country next year. More details are available on our website, abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Next week, a multifaceted portrait of the enigmatic and edgy Australian photographer Carol Jerrems. Jerrems' portraits of the 1970s, from emerging feminists of the era through to leading Australian rock bands like Skyhooks, are candid, liberated and thought-provoking.
We lived in the moment very much, the group of people there, and we had a culture all around us, you know, people making circuses without animals and feminist musicians and writers and people making rock bands with real Australian stories in them, things like that.
This suite of three photographs is really significant because Carol was directly involved with the band Skyhooks and photographed them throughout the 70s. In fact, she produced most of the images for Jenny Brown's book Million Dollar Riff.
Outback loved her work and they asked her and me to collaborate on a book about Skyhooks, which was Million Dollar Riff. It came out in 1975. And so Carol, you know, came into the backstage rooms and things like that. My boyfriend at the time was Greg McCainch, and in time he moved into Mozart Street too. Carol was for some time in 74 very close to the band, and they were certainly hitting some very slightly surreal heights of fame at that time in Australia, and Australian bands weren't used to that kind of thing.
And we have three images here, two of Red Simons and one of Shirley Strawn. And I think what's interesting is that Carol chose to portray them not with their on-stage flamboyant glory, but very much behind the scenes, deep in thought. Red Simons is looking into a mirror, applying his makeup. Shirley Strawn is looking aside near a mirror.
She liked to get in backstage and catch those ordinary moments, or the moments where the clown, the, you know, Shirley Strawn, was just sad and lonely, tired, wanted to be somewhere else, as well as the wonderful moments with, you know, Red and Greg applying layers of pancake, and the layers and layers that they applied to themselves and their personas. And without Carol's work, there'd be a lot more of a glossy upfront image of Skyhooks. There wouldn't be so much of the real people for others to find.
On this wall, this kind of dazzling silver wall, we have some of Carol's most famous images, in particular Vale Street from 1975. This has become an icon of 20th century Australian photography, and it kind of marks the maturity of Carol's work.
Vale Street is a striking photograph. Confronting the viewer's gaze is a confident, beautiful young woman with long hair. She's naked to the waist of her jeans, adorned only by an ankh pendant on a chain around her neck, suggestive of the symbol for women's liberation. She stepped into the light, and skulking in the shadows behind her lurked two young Sharpie males, tattooed and also bare-chested. Curator Gail Newton wrote of a goddess with her attendant satyrs. Katrina Brown, the subject of Vale Street, taken in 1975, is instantly recognisable 35 years later when she flew in from Mexico for the launch of Carol's exhibition.
I can't identify when I first met Carol. We were all part of the same scene in Melbourne in the 70s and 80s. When I was at high school, I used to hang with a lot of very interesting people, performing arts group called The Tribe, and the people that started the La Mama, and various other filmmakers and musicians of the time. It was a fairly small art scene in Melbourne, and everybody in it knew each other. In that year, I was in Melbourne and heading to Sydney to sell my soul to whoever would buy me as an actress or a television actress or in theatre, and I needed a portfolio of photos. I asked Carol if she would do a headshot for me. And of course, Carol wasn't a commercial photographer, but she was really the only friend I had who was a proper photographer. So I asked her, and she didn't really want to, but she agreed to do it as long as she could use my photos in her portfolio so she could show her work. And of course, I agreed.
That's After Images, Carol Gerrans Through a Lens. Don't miss it next week here on Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. I look forward to your company then, here on ABC Radio National.
Take a look at the multicultural metropolis that is Karachi in Pakistan.
In this economic situation of the Pakistan, it's very difficult to live for an ordinary man.
Poverty and violence are commonplace and at an all-time high.
This double bombing defies belief.
The blast ripped through the headquarters of the city.
Karachi, a wounded city.
If you have your connections, if you have your power, that's how you survive.
Download this 360 documentary from the Radio National website.